Hi, I'm Jamie Gerchik. We're here to talk with John Keller of CBS4 in Boston, Massachusetts, about his new book, The Blue Estate. Hi, John.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you?
I'm fine, and I'll be a lot better if everyone will, after they watch this, rush right out and buy multiple copies of The Blue Estate, How Democrats Created the Massachusetts Blueprint for American Political Disaster. Because I have two college tuitions I'm trying to pay off.
I understand. I should say this is very surreal for me, having grown up watching you on TV in Boston, to be doing this. But I'm honored.
The honor is mine. Keep in mind the camera adds 10 pounds.
Oh, I'll have to do something about that. Why don't you tell us about your book?
Okay. Oh, I'm so glad. You mean The Blue Estate?
Yes,
let me tell you a little
bit
about it. The premise is that I'm a longtime political reporter here in the Boston area. I've covered Massachusetts politics really going back to the late 70s. And my book, The Blue Estate, is about the hash that a generation, the baby boom generation of liberal Democrats, in almost unchallenged control of Massachusetts governance and politics, have made of the Kennedy era promise to produce a political culture that focuses on elevating the working class and providing opportunities for the poor and minorities to have a seat at the table.
And you name names, too.
I name names, I take no prisoners, and the bottom line is, and the most damning fact among the many in the Blue Estate, is that only one state in the nation has experienced net population loss over this past decade. In 2 years, Massachusetts has lost population. No other state can match that record of futility. That is the sound of predominantly younger working class people voting with their feet as they flee the People's Republic in search of some kind of economic opportunity.
I myself just moved last month from the People's Republic of Cambridge here in Washington, so I can attest to that.
Yeah.
High tax burden, enormous electric bills, personally. You could probably tell us more about that. But
of course, when you talk about the tax burden here,
yeah.
You barely get the words out of your mouth when the liberal elites and their apologists jump down your throat about, well, this study here shows we're only 28th, and that study here shows we're only 17th. Of course, tax burden is only part of the story. The cost of living, the total cost of living for working people is out of control here. You're talking about taxes, yes. You're also talking about energy. In a state where the political leadership, with the notable and laudable exception of our new governor, DeVal Patrick, is uniformly opposed to the development of offshore wind energy off the coast of Cape Cod. Why? Because it would interfere, supposedly, with the view from the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport.
Well, I'm actually working on a story right now in Cape Wind, so I'm not going to show my cards, but... That's a good example. Yeah.
You're talking about the cost of living, all the different things that add up, crumbling roads and bridges, public schools that are so bad in many cases it forces people to shell out for parochial or private education. Mm-hmm. This is not a worker's paradise. In fact, it's a worker's nightmare. And my book calls out the baby boom liberal elites of Massachusetts for their utter failure to deliver on the promise that I grew up ascribing to, the John, Bobby, and to a great extent Ted Kennedy promise that liberal politics would be about elevating working class people, not sending them screaming into the night.
Now, is it fair to say that your book is an answer to Tom Frank's what's the matter with Kansas? The answer is Massachusetts. Is that what you're trying to say?
Not so much an answer as a companion piece. Mm-hmm. I really liked Frank's book. I thought his diagnosis of the manipulation, primarily cultural manipulation, that the right wing has used over the years to sway voters is right on in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
What I took from his book as a sort of a jumping off point from mine was his puzzlement, his bafflement at the fact that voters consistently choose Republican candidates in Kansas when it's clearly in their better economic interests to vote for the Democrat? Well, not always so. I beg to differ. Mm. Not that I'm carrying water for the Republicans. The Republican Party in Massachusetts has been pathetic and not much better at the national level. But my book argues that it's the Democrats who provide the Republicans time and again with the raw material that they need to make their manipulation work with their own oftentimes idiotic devotion to political correctness and to attitudes that estrange them from the very voters they need to be wooing.
I want to go back to your book, but you brought up a good point, which is Democrats providing easy fodder for the right to seize on. And we just saw last week Barack Obama saying that he's not wearing an American flag lapel pin because he thinks it's an expression of false patriotism or jingoism, or it's a substitute for patriotism and has become associated with support for the Iraq War. What do you think of that?
I think it's absolutely appalling. Mm. And one of the dumber things I've ever seen an allegedly serious presidential candidate say. I guess it was kind of an offhand exchange at the end of an interview with a local TV reporter. You got to watch out for those local TV reporters.
They're
like landmines, you know. what is he trying to say? First of all, this whole notion that overt displays of patriotism have come to equal warmongering is a cultural conceit of the cocktail party liberals who believe that Fox News is the incarnation of all that is evil in modern civilization.
I think you make a good point. I wouldn't deny, though, that to a large extent the right has hijacked patriotism in a pretty distasteful way. But I think we would agree is to say that just because Sean Hannity, you know, wears an American flag pin, or Fox always has a waving American flag, you know, under its name, doesn't obviate your ability to be patriotic as a liberal. And it doesn't mean that you can't also fly an American flag outside your house or wear one on your pin. I think it actually provides you an opportunity to reclaim patriotism from the right. I mean,
I'm not big on wearing jewelry other than my wedding ring, which I can't take off. It's sutured to me. And I certainly would not equate the wearing of patriotic jewelry with actual patriotism. Of course, that's ridiculous. But why cede that ground to the right? And that's repeatedly what I see. I have a whole chapter in my book, The Blue Estate. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
That talks about, and I go back to Gene Kirkpatrick's famous line, and I believe it was the 1984
Republican convention in
San Francisco Democrats, and how they always blame America first.
Yes.
And I update that here in Massachusetts by telling the story of a press conference broadcast live back to Venezuela by Venezuelan TV, featuring Joe Kennedy, at that point a former congressman, but the nephew of Ted and son of Bobby Kennedy, Ed Markey and Bill Delahunt, prominent members of the mass congressional delegation, celebrating one of Hugo Chavez's publicity stunt shipments of low-cost heating oil to be distributed to low-income, needy households in the Boston area, and using it as a jumping-off point to, at one point, I believe it was Joe Kennedy said, the people in Venezuela are lucky. They have a president who really cares about the poor, unlike here. Well, you know, given what we know about Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, it just strikes me that that is a profoundly politically stupid thing to say and a stupid attitude to cop. And when I talk about cocktail party liberalism, it's exactly the kind of self-amusing behavior that boomer liberals love to engage in and that Obama was engaging in with his little monologue about the flag pin that sets you up to be victimized by the Sean Hannitys of the world and sets you up for failure at the polls. And without the power, you really aren't in a position to do anything much more than go to more cocktail parties when you and your friends can regale each other about the moral purity of your refusal to wear a flag pin. What's that all about?
Well, let's go. I want to talk more about your book, and I want to talk about Deval Patrick, who's been, there's a lot of national attention on him. I believe he's the only black governor in the country right now.
Appallingly, yes.
He's a very eloquent, intelligent man. But he made some really stupid mistakes in his first weeks in office. I mean, we had spending several tens of thousands of dollars on drapes and new office furniture. We had him replacing Governor Romney's old Ford car that he drove around in as governor with a Cadillac, getting him the name Cadillac Duval. There was hiring a scheduler for his wife to the tune of $72,000 to the taxpayers. Arguably, these are stupid mistakes. Do you think that they were blown out of proportion by the media, in particular the Boston Herald? Or are they actually emblematic of some of the larger themes that you talk about in your book?
I think they're emblematic. Were they blown out of proportion? Well, you know, sure, to the extent that we always in the media are looking for symbolic stories. And also, we're looking for gotcha stories,
right.
Stories that, you know, belie your spin about who you are. That here in Massachusetts, you know, we, and as part of our rich political heritage, going back several hundred years here, you may recall, we have never had much affection for royalty here. We don't have a governor's mansion.
Right.
You know, we don't like affectations like that, the trappings of power. And so to the extent that right out of the box, after he's campaigned very successfully on by speaking to the economic distress of the people of Massachusetts, so we've never really recovered very much from the last recession here, to come right out of the box, and these are the first news stories coming out of your office.
Right.
You know, absolutely disgraceful. It said something very revealing about Deval Patrick, something that has continued to be revealed in other more substantive policy positions he's taken, that he's really a sort of an African-American liberal version of Mitt Romney, a CEO type who came not out of business but out of executive leadership positions and out of the world of law, without any real understanding of the world of politics,
right.
Of the nature of legislative affairs, and as someone who's used to saying jump and everybody around you just wants to know how high.
But isn't there something to be said for having the outsider? I mean, one of the biggest complaints you hear in Massachusetts, and when I was living there, something that really frustrated me, is this whole clubby, it's the old club that runs the state. And I'm going to admit, you know, I voted for Mitt Romney enthusiastically in 2002, before he became a right-wing zealot. But, and I think, you know, he won. He won a resounding victory, I think primarily for being sort of a white knight who came in and was promising to clean up the state. He went after Billy Bulger, which was terrific, this, you know, criminal who, you know, was bilking hundreds of thousands of dollars every year out of the state through this ridiculous pension system that we have in Massachusetts. So isn't there something to be said about having an outsider, someone like Deval Patrick, who's not a part of the old Beacon Hill Club that we hear so much about?
Sure. I mean, this is a state, keep in mind, that actually voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980 and 1984.
That's forgotten,
And, you know, voted for Romney and for two Republicans before him, even as they're electing Democrats to everything else, out of a sense of desperation and a notion that there needed to be some element of balance and, yes, that an outsider could come in. And both in, you know, Romney's case, although Romney has lived here for many years, he's got Utah and Michigan written all over him.
Right.
And Deval Patrick also is from Chicago and unmistakably Midwestern, a sense that even though we're a very parochial place in many ways, there's a sense that, you know, maybe we don't know it all and we do need the occasional outsider to come in and kind of help set the townie straight a little bit. You know, unfortunately, as you, I believe you used the word clubby to describe Massachusetts, and it was always thus. I don't want to lay that strictly at the feet of the baby boom, but let's be honest, there's nothing more insular than a baby boomer with power. Nothing more isolated and aloof and arrogant than a baby boomer politician who doesn't fear what might happen when he or she is up for re-election. And that's the situation we have here in Massachusetts. We're all familiar with the stereotypical, unctuous, moralistic baby boomer who believes that their received wisdom is God-given, or if they don't believe in God, is self-given, and it trumps all all potential reality checks, all dissent. Massachusetts, the Massachusetts political culture is a place that brooks no dissent, never admits error. And you see that, frankly, in the right-wing republicanism as well. Look at the Bush years. Right. How much more arrogant and insular can you get than the Bush foreign policy in Iraq? So this transcends Massachusetts, of course. I just argue in my book, The Bluest State, that it runs amok here. And to the extent that Massachusetts exerts disproportionate influence right. on the Democratic Party, that's a poison that's injected into the party's bloodstream.
And you go after the baby boomers a lot, and it sounds like you have a lot against them. Have you been getting... I'm 23, and I really liked your book. Is there a difference in the reactions that you've been getting based upon the age of the readership?
Yeah, so far it's incredible. Well, I get a lot of emails from people of all generations, but primarily younger, who have either fled Massachusetts right. in recent years or are in the process of doing so. But yeah, it's interesting just in terms of the reviewers. Baby boomer reviewers... some get it, some definitely do not, and they're outraged by it. Again, this speaks to the baby boomer reluctance to acknowledge any criticism, why mm-hmm. we're the best and the brightest, you know? Generation X and younger reviewers and readers love it. They hate us anyway. They're so sick of us. They're sick of our squandering of their future. In the many ways, there are refusal to reform Social Security,
right.
Our cavalier edifice complex policy making, whether it's the war in Iraq or the Big Dig here in Massachusetts, as a whole generation of younger Massachusetts residents have seen their financial futures ruined by the folly of the Big Dig.
Right.
So there's a real gap there. Now, I don't know you personally, Jamie. I take you for not a baby boomer, though. Am I
no,
right?
No, 23, so...
Yeah, so I think there's definitely a generation gap there, and hopefully Gen Xers are big book buyers, and we'll all run out at Christmas time and stock up on copies
I'll tell
of
all my friends,
The Bluest State.
What distinguishes the baby boomer Massachusetts political culture from that of Ted Kennedy or Tip O'Neill, which is arguably... you know, more into bloated government, more into patronage, and, you know, all these things that we don't like. You know, how is the baby boomer generation? Is it worse? Does it differ from the old guard of Massachusetts politics?
In my view, the most dramatic way in which it's different is that, and you're right, you know, Tip O'Neill, certainly, he was Speaker of the House in Massachusetts.
Who's responsible for the Big Dig?
He was the one who got the funding originally and guided it over Ronald Reagan's veto. That's
right.
correct. However, it's interesting, if you go back in the history of the Big Dig, Tip expressed concern about the cost of this mushrooming out of control and what that might do to working people in Massachusetts.
Tip O'Neill expressed concern about a federal government program mushrooming out of control?
Yes, he did. Yes,
I'm
he
astonished.
Did. And I would argue that in O'Neill, and particularly in Ted Kennedy... In the case of Ted Kennedy, here you have a generation that, whatever its warts, and no generation is without them, has kept its eye on the ball of what working people really need. Look at Ted Kennedy's agenda over
right.
the years.
Right.
For every foreign policy tangent where he's sort of gone off to the left of the boat there, health care. Affordable health care for poor people,
mm-hmm.
The minimum wage, bread and butter issues
right.
that speak to the day-to-day ability of working class and poor families to feed their children and
right.
care for them. I argue those are unassailable. That's an unassailable agenda. That's exactly where Democrats, where all elected officials should be focusing. Well-off people can take care of themselves. All right? It's the poor and the working classes that need the help that should be getting it. But that focus has been very much lost by a younger generation of political leadership styling themselves in the Kennedy legacy, but forgetting that part of it. And again, not really hearing criticism of how they've lost control of it because... You know, they're doing what they feel is right. How can that be wrong? That's the baby boomer mantra that we see over and over again in Massachusetts politics and on the national scale as well. We've had two successive waves of baby boomer leadership in Congress that I would argue have been abject failures.
Mm-hmm.
First a Democratic wave, now a Republican, now we're seeing another Democratic wave. They've got a long way to go to improve on this, or rather, it won't be hard for them to improve on the track record that's been established by the first boomer wave.
Now, do you see? I want to get into a few of the disagreements I had with your book, if that's okay, if you'll permit me. Tom Finneran, who Speaker of the House for many years, Democrat, who became Speaker of the House, I should add, only with the support of Republicans, which is true. He's a convicted felon. He perjured himself in a lawsuit or in a case involving voter
redistricting.
District realignment, I believe, with minority voters.
Yeah, redistricting of House districts, right.
And he often got a lot of criticism, I think justified, for, you know, running the state as his own sort of personal fiefdom, his thwarting of clean elections, which was a government-funded sponsorship
public
of campaigns.
Finance.
Public funding of campaigns, which I support in a state like Massachusetts, which is run by one party. I think that's actually a very important program. Now, Finneran, you were totally—you gave him the kid gloves treatment, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who, to me, represents a lot of what's wrong in the state. He might not be the sort of boomer narcissist in terms of all the, you know, political correctness and and social spending and all that sort of stuff that you criticize. But again, with the patronage and the petty grievances that he would. Sending reps that he didn't like, giving them, you know, awful offices in the corner of the building, little stuff like that. But, you know, in particular, the way he thwarted clean elections, which was supported, by the way, by two-thirds of Massachusetts voters in a referendum. What's your thoughts on him, and why did you go easy on him?
No question about it. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The Speaker of the Massachusetts House has something approaching absolute power.
Right.
And there were numerous instances of Tom Finneran, in my view, as well as obviously yours, abused that power when he was Speaker of the House. And I called him on it in my reporting. He served a purpose in the context of my book. That was somewhat different.
Mm.
But I take your point. I can't exactly be sitting here lambasting boomers for not being open to criticism without taking some with magnanimity myself. So I accept that. So that's one point. With regard to clean elections, I think there is an intellectually defensible argument against clean elections.
Sure.
In fact, during the brief period of time, what Finneran did was the Clean Elections Public Financing Law was approved by the public in a referendum vote. He refused to fund it.
Yes.
In the House.
And the state had to go to the extent that they were auctioning off state property, vehicles
state,
and land.
The state Supreme Court had to step in and ordered him to comply. But don't forget what happened with the first wave of that money. The first clean elections gubernatorial candidate here in Massachusetts, and really the only one so far, was Warren Tolman.
Whom I should disclose, I did work for him in my younger days, so I should disclose that.
Did you work for him in the 2002 race?
In the 2002 gubernatorial election, I was a campaign staffer, yes.
Okay, well then you will recall what Warren did with his clean elections money. His first TV ad was an ad about the fact that Warren is bald. And it was arguing that bald is beautiful.
I mean, it was a campaign.
That's
the point of public financing law, is to fund campaigns. And if you're going to monitor, if you're going to monitor what's allowable, what's acceptable, I guess you're making the argument that we shouldn't be funding campaigns because this is what it goes to.
Argue that in that one instance, we saw that just the funding, public funding of an otherwise underfunded campaign doesn't necessarily result in an elevated political discourse or in a better type of politics. Warren's a good guy.
Right.
But was he clearly, far and away the best individual for the job in that case? I would say that's debatable.
He got the signatures to qualify for the money.
Yes, he did. But all I'm saying is there is an intellectually defensible case that that's a waste of taxpayer dollars.
Sure. No,
that in fact it makes sense to let, if you will, the market speak a little bit, and let the necessity of raising a certain amount of money in order to be a competitive candidate be a bit of a filter to screen out the assorted kooks and nuts.
Right.
However, I take it there's a perfectly defensible argument for clean elections, in which you can feel free to make if you want. All I'm saying is that Finneran clearly believed that clean elections was a waste of taxpayer dollars. It was certainly not a case of him feeling threatened in terms of his political power.
No.
By the onset of public financing. So let's give him credit for making, an intellectual argument against it.
You don't think that if clean elections had been successfully implemented, you would have seen a new batch of candidates, perhaps Republicans, perhaps more liberal Democrats, coming and perhaps ousting him somehow in some far-off fantasy or no?
You know, here in Massachusetts, as opposed to other states where it has worked somewhat better, I doubt it.
Right.
Because the political culture here is so hidebound,
yes,
so controlled by an in-group, that it's
right,
not just a question of not having enough dough to not having an ante to be able to play. It's a question of if this is said many times, and another criticism that I've heard of my book and that I acknowledge is valid is that I toss around the word liberal as a defining word maybe a little bit too much.
Mm.
I perhaps would have been better off in hindsight making it clear that the really defining characteristic of Massachusetts politics is not liberals versus conservatives, or even Democrats versus Republicans. It's insiders versus outsiders. Now, the fact that most of the insiders tend to be liberal Democrats, should be noted. But, yeah, it's insiders versus outsiders. And, unfortunately, what has happened is the outsider groups here really encompass working class people, black people, poor people, all of the people that liberal Democratic insiders swear they're fighting for every day. The hypocrisy of it is just monumental.
Hmm. What would you say about all the social spending? And I mean, you write a lot about Barbara Anderson, who's sort of a legend in Massachusetts, this anti-tax campaigner. Is it fair to say that the poor are outsiders in Massachusetts? Are an outside group?
A lot of money is spent here,
right,
certainly, although not in every area. We spend less on public higher education than all but one other state. Massachusetts, which is really incredible.
That's surprising.
To his credit, yeah. Governor Patrick just today has announced a plan to try to rectify that somewhat. Huh. But even in that sense, our priorities are skewed. But certainly we've had a welfare state,
right,
spending per capita on public education that's up there among the states.
Right.
And the fact is, for the most part, people here, there's a legacy of progressivism, of supporting an activist state government that goes way, way back in Massachusetts history, and it's still very much alive today. Most people in Massachusetts are not with Barbara Anderson and her anti-tax movement,
sure,
not like you have in some other states. But nonetheless, there's a limit. And
yeah,
the Massachusetts political culture repeatedly crosses over the line, exceeds the limit, takes a cavalier attitude toward taxpayer money. In Massachusetts, back when we, just like the federal government, were engaging in the great welfare reform debate of the early to mid-90s, the remedies, the welfare reforms that came in were significantly more draconian and harsh than they needed to be, because the advocates, liberal advocates of the welfare status quo, excuse me, were completely unwilling to admit any excess, any error. If you spoke up against welfare fraud, if you spoke out against draconian tax hikes, you were mean-spirited.
Yes.
and you were lectured that all we were asking in this latest tax hike was for you to forego a pizza a week.
Well, it's like the debate over S-CHIP, where President Bush apparently wants poor children to get sick and die because he doesn't believe in expanding this federal program to middle-class families.
That's a good example, Jamie. I can't swallow that spin.
Yeah.
Whatever the arguments for S-CHIP, the fact is that George Bush does not want children to get sick and die. It's an argument over how much funding for S-CHIP should be increased and whether or not that's taking us down a policy road that we do or don't want to get into.
Right.
It's not an argument over who wants to let children die in a snowbank.
Right.
And that's exactly the kind of excess that liberal Democrats in Massachusetts so frequently engage in. And frankly, It more often than not, it boomerangs on them, it backfires on them, and undercuts their credibility with economically beleaguered voters.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is Mitt Romney. I don't know if you saw this advertisement that the Log Cabin Republicans put out last week, which is the gay Republican group, in which they said that Mitt Romney embodies, I believe it was, Massachusetts values. He's pro-choice, and showed all these old quotes from him debating Ted Kennedy in 94 and Shannon O'Brien in 2002. And all they didn't mention is support of gay rights, which I thought was perplexing, seeing as this ad was coming from a gay organization. But nonetheless, do you think it's kind of remarkable to the extent to which Massachusetts values can just suddenly conjures up all these horrible images in certain people's minds?
Yeah, because up until modern times, Massachusetts values were a beacon for the nation.
Classical liberal values,
This is the home of the abolitionist movement.
Right.
This is the home of
Kennedy.
Kennedy. Well, and the Kennedys, the new frontier.
Right.
I mean, these are values I certainly still hold dear today, and I think most Americans do. Massachusetts values has come to mean aloofness, arrogance, excess. Romney, to me, his campaign is a tribute not to Massachusetts values, but to narcissistic boomer values.
Yeah.
He believes, apparently, that it's okay for him to jettison his clearly long-held beliefs. I believe he's always been pro-life. He was raised in a Mormon household.
In
Michigan, and I believe that he has always said that he opposes gay marriage. But in the interests of getting himself elected, he pretended to be benign on choice. I would never do anything to overturn Roe v. Wade. That's what he said in 94 and in 2002.
Right.
Now he's running on a platform of repealing Roe v. Wade. It's strictly out of political expedience.
Yeah, so you're saying that Romney isn't lying now. He was lying when he was running in Massachusetts. So he's actually
being, that's right. And he's lying now about the circumstances.
About his history, right. But he's being the honest. He's actually expressing his honest beliefs about what he actually does believe in now running for president. But he had to fake it.
He has reverted back to what he really believes after lying about that, and he's lying about the circumstances of the reversion. Yes.
And it's catching up. Yeah, and I think you would probably agree. It's catching up with him. I mean, it's almost been impossible for him to back down this criticism. I mean, it's just so blatant.
Well, his only real hope is that he somehow, Rudy Giuliani's been doing some pandering of his own.
Right.
And his only hope is that he gets in there in the final against Hillary Clinton, who's sort of the Democratic queen of the expedient flip-flop.
Right.
And that it kind of cancels itself out. But, he is in that way, while a fine fellow in many ways, he's also a classic case study in the boomer narcissism that believes that the personal ends justify the political means in all cases. Situational ethics.
Yes.
That's something that only a boomer could dream up.
And we don't have much time left, but I wanna throw out an idea which I think is pretty controversial, but I think you might agree with me. Do you think if Rudy Giuliani is the nominee, is the Republican nominee, that the Massachusetts might go red in 2008?
Yes, I do. Very interesting observation by you. In fact,
I would actually extend that and say McCain as well. I think McCain or Rudy could take Massachusetts in a general election?
We just did some polling. The TV station I work for here in Boston, WBZ, did some polling of mythical presidential matchups in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And just a quick sidebar here, one amusing finding was that in a matchup with Hillary Clinton, between Hillary Clinton and Romney, 44% of voters who identified themselves to our robo-poll as pro-lifers would vote for Hillary.
Wow.
Which is like saying you'd vote for Satan over Mitt Romney. That's
right.
The level of the antipathy toward Romney here in Massachusetts. But, yeah, in those matchups, Giuliani did the best of any Republican here.
What was the split?
Well, in a matchup with Obama, he comes within 8 points. It was like 48-40.
It's pretty good for him.
I mean, that was the closest he came to any of the other big Democratic candidates.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a chance. Like I say, this is a state that voted for Reagan in 80 and 84, has elected three Republican governors in recent memory.
Mm.
However, this is also Hillary country. It's Clinton country, big time. They love her here.
Right.
So that would be a tough matchup for him. But he is Northeastern. He does represent the kind of Republican who has been successful here. Fiscally conservative, but socially progressive, yes.
Right. Just, while we're on that, don't you think it's interesting that Paul Cellucci, who preceded Mitt Romney as governor, as a Republican governor of Massachusetts, is supporting Giuliani? Does that say anything about the way the Mass GOP ethic has been abandoned by Romney, and also how Massachusetts Republicans are just embittered towards Romney for kind of ruining the party in that state?
It speaks to that, however, frankly, the party was ruined long before Romney got here. It was Bill Weld with Paul Cellucci as his lieutenant governor who presided over they came in 1990 in a big voter anger backlash.
Right.
And they also came in with enough state senators, Republican state senators, to sustain a gubernatorial veto. It took them 2 years to lose that.
Right.
Ever since, Republican governors have operated in an environment where their vetoes can be overridden on a straight party line vote.
Right.
And it was Cellucci and Weld who let what appeared to be a resurgent Massachusetts Republican Party kind of wither away and die. Romney, of course, did give it the old college try in the 2006 legislative election.
He didn't pick up a single seat, right?
He not only didn't pick up a seat, he lost
seats. Yeah.
He spent a lot of money. He campaigned. He put together a slate of candidates.
He had that huge unveiling in the State House, right? He had 100 candidates behind
him.
Right. Yeah.
John Kerry, of course, was running for president in 06. There was a huge Democratic turnout here. It just swamped the boat. But and then Romney spent the last 2 years of his term running for president and bad-mouthing Massachusetts. The Republican Party here is in such a deep hole, it could be a generation or more before they dig themselves out. It's pathetic.
Wow. Well, I think that's all the time we have.
Well, listen, let's to be continued. We could probably spend a whole nother Blogging Head segment talking about the gay marriage battle.
We could.
And some of the decisions that were made here. But in the meantime, let me say thank you to you, Jamie. And
thank you.
Don't forget, Christmas shopping season is right around the corner. The Blue Estate, St. Martin's Press.
Well, I was just going to say, John, you know, you've complained a lot about all these awful presidential candidates who come from Massachusetts. But they do help the local reporters like you. I mean, now you have all these stories you can do about Romney, and before that, Kerry and Dukakis. I mean, it's just like a never-ending supply of national attention that you guys get.
I freely admit, for someone like me, it's hog heaven.
All right, thanks, John.
Thanks, Jamie.
Bye.
Bye.